Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this day after the big election, and we will talk about it for the full 2 hours today. We'll have many guests with us. Professor Kathleen Dolan is with us the first hour of the show, professor of political science at the University of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We will also be speaking with a national political reporter for the Boston Globe, and we will be speaking with a reporter from The Hill, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls. Hour two, we will have guests with us. Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Chuck Kornbach, based here in Milwaukee. Brian Bull, who is a producer and reporter for Northeast Ohio Public Radio. Interesting doings in Ohio last night. And Cameron Joseph, staff writer for The Hill. So all of those people are joining us. And we, of course, welcome your phone calls after all these months of talking about what happened. Let's talk about what we did yesterday. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave a message there, we'd love to hear from you, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Kathleen Dolan, welcome. Hello. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
How late a night was it for you?
Oh, I stayed up until after the president's speech, and then I decided I could go to bed without knowing about Florida.
And I guess we won't know about Florida until this afternoon.
That's right.
Yeah. So were there any great surprises yesterday? It was interesting as I was looking at it. It seemed to me as though the strategy that the president had in mind was carried through pretty flawlessly, that they knew where they wanted to go and they were successful.
That's right. The president, you know, the Democrats entered this presidential race knowing, as did the Republicans, that there were 9 states up for grabs. The president appears to have won 8 of those 9. The only states that he won in 08 that he lost last night were Indiana and North Carolina, which were such shocks in 08 anyway that, you know, them reverting back to their normal voting patterns is really not surprising. So the president's team put together in many ways a close to flawless strategy in just about running the table on the battleground states they needed.
What does it mean for a president to be reelected, Professor Dolan? Does it make it a more significant presidency?
Well, I think it reaffirms the sorts of approach and message that a president is putting out there. You know, we talk in political science about voters being retrospective voters, by which we mean that they look back at a president and they think about what they've experienced in the last 4 years, and they're really choosing, do they want more of that or do they want a different path? And in 2008, after 8 years of President Bush, it was pretty clear, you know, to us that in looking back at the Republican brand, in 08, people were choosing the Democrat. Last night, it was the same opportunity for people to say, you know, are we happy with what we've experienced over the last 4 years? Do we want to cast our lot to continue down that path, or do we want to shift again? And I think the president can rightly claim that people looked and said, you know, we're not where we want to be. Things are not perfect yet, but we're moving in perhaps the right direction, and it's too early yet to decide that we need to change.
Do you see a similar relationship with the Senate, which remains Democratic, although the Democrats did pick a couple seats? The House is pretty much the same. Things are relatively the same, aren't they?
They are, except in congressional elections, particularly in House elections, it's very difficult to unseat incumbents. So, you know, the real sort of set in stone piece for what happened last night with regard to the House was what happened in 2010. So the sort of wave election of 2010 that gave control of the House to Republicans. You know, House Republicans are very hard to defeat, and there were very few people who thought that the Democrats could really retake control yesterday, because it was clear that even if President Obama won a comfortable Electoral College victory, that it wasn't going to be also a, you know, overwhelming vote sort of on the ground. So it's not surprising that the two chambers of Congress stay the way that they did. The Democrats, I think, in the Senate did overperform at some level. They picked up 2 pretty important seats. There's still 2 outstanding seats where they are leading. So it looks like when they bring the independents into the caucus, you know, they'll have 55 seats moving forward. So the Democrats have done a little better, and they've shifted in some ways the ideological tendency of the Senate by including Tammy Baldwin and Elizabeth Warren, who are probably a little more progressive than the average Democrat in the Senate. So the Democrats, I think, can feel as if they've extended their lead a little bit in the Senate, but they will still be balanced by a House that is almost completely unchanged with regard to ideology and with regard to party control. That is as much about the institutional challenges of defeating incumbents in House races as it is any sort of, you know, balancing attempt ideologically that voters made yesterday.
How significant was the gender gap?
It was bigger than it was in 2008. President Obama got 55% of the votes of women, and he got 45% of the votes of men. So in 08, I believe it was 7 percentage points was the gap between women's directional turnout and men's, or vote choice, pardon me. So he widened it a little bit last night. Women and men were the same percentage of the electorate in both 08 and 12, so women have been consistently about 53% of the electorate. But they increased their support for President Obama a little bit, and male support for President Obama went down a little bit to create a 10 percentage point gap.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about Florida, and it looks as though it may happen, Florida, although who knows what happens in Florida. But if indeed the president should eke out a victory in Florida, so many people were saying last night that the population group that made a huge difference in this election was the Latino vote. People needed to pay attention to that vote.
And I think they need to pay attention to it around the country. I mean, we saw it in Colorado. It looks like we're seeing it in Florida. We're seeing it in places like Virginia. You know, President Obama was able to hang on and win Virginia again. The demographics of the country are changing. Nevada as well has seen increased Latino integration into the state. The demographics of the United States are changing. Latinos are an exploding population. Latino men went about 65% for President Obama last night. Latino women 76% for President Obama. So the Republican Party does have a challenge in trying to appeal to and capture what is only going to be an increasingly important group.
They'll have to change who they are in some respect. They'll have to, look at issues like immigration reform? Is that the big issue here? Because it's interesting that this particular president has deported more people. It's been a big part of his administration, and yet there is hope that things will get better. Explain this to me.
Well, the president, the Obama administration has indeed deported more people who are illegal than previous administrations. The Obama administration would argue that that was because of increased enforcement of deporting people who were here after having committed crimes and were who could be sort of adjudicated as more of a threat. But that is a place where Latino and Latina voters have been somewhat disappointed in the president. However, there is really such a stark difference between the two parties with regard to the DREAM Act and with any sort of path to citizenship for people who are here illegally that I think that overwhelms a concern about deportation issues. The Republicans have a challenge, you know, on their face, literally, right? They are a party that is much whiter than
yes.
the country and much more male and much more southern than the country as a whole. If they want to become, moving forward, anything other than a minority party that appeals to southern white rural voters, they have to change on many levels. You know, they have a woman problem. They have a Latino and Latina problem. So I think we don't know what the postmortem is going to be. We said the same things after 2004 and after 2008, and the Republican Party has not fundamentally changed. But they do, at their risk, I think, if they continue to ignore demographic changes and the sort of broad-based, you know, what some people are calling, you know, this post-racial coalition, this multiracial coalition that the Democrats are putting together, they ignore that at their long-term peril.
Kathleen Dolan remaining with us during the course of this hour, so feel free, Professor Dolan, to question our next guest, and we'll be taking phone calls during the hour as well. So please call in and we'll get to you, I promise, 800-486-8655. Matt Visor is joining us momentarily, national political reporter at the Boston Globe. He has been covering Mitt Romney and, of course, the campaign for quite some time. In case you missed, this did come in a little bit late last night, although not as late as we thought it might be. This is the concession speech from Governor Mitt Romney last night.
Our leaders have to reach across the aisle to do the people's work. And we citizens also have to rise to the occasion. We look to our teachers and professors. We count on you not just to teach, but to inspire our children with a passion for learning and discovery. We look to our pastors and priests and rabbis and counselors of all kinds to testify of the enduring principles upon which our society is built: honesty, charity, integrity, and family. We look to our parents. From the final analysis, everything depends on the success of our homes. We look to job creators of all kinds. We're counting on you to invest, to hire, to step forward. And we look to Democrats and Republicans in government at all levels to put the people before the politics.
Matt Visor is joining us now, along with Professor Kathleen Dolan. Matt is national political reporter at the Boston Globe. Hello, Matt. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Why did Governor Romney fall short?
I think, you know, several reasons. One was one period that you'd kind of point to is over the summer when the Obama campaign sort of went directly after him, and was very aggressive in sort of branding him in the minds of voters. The Romney campaign sort of took the approach that voters wouldn't tune in until later. But it appears that in some ways it was too late for Romney to sort of shift course.
Mm-hmm. Were there any surprises that you saw last night? Were there places that he did well that surprised you, places where he fell very short that surprised you?
I was a little surprised that Romney fell as short as he did. There did seem to be, kind of in the final days of the race, something organic happening for Mitt Romney. His rallies were more boisterous and better attended than at any point in his campaign. So it did seem like he was building something, but the results clearly show that there was, the movement was not widespread by any means. Mm-hmm. You know, the Obama campaign was much more effective at getting voters to the polls and identifying their core supporters.
We are a nation that so much has this 24-hour news cycle, and I wonder how often things change as a result of that cycle. A lot has been said about this huge national disaster that hit us that put him off the front page, put him off television for almost a week. Do you think that was significant?
I think it certainly played a role and played a factor, maybe in Mitt Romney closing the gap, but most polls still had him trailing in a lot of the states that he needed to win, and including, most importantly, perhaps Ohio. You know, so he was already down before the hurricane struck, but the hurricane sort of allowed President Obama to sort of seize a moment, and it prevented Mitt Romney from really gaining more traction. So I think it had an impact. I don't know that it was a turning point necessarily.
Professor Dolan, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think Hurricane Sandy may be a sort of easy go-to explanation that people may try to make. I don't think it had much of an impact. While the campaign was disrupted for a couple of days, it really wasn't more than 2 or 3 days that the candidates were off the trail. And quite honestly, while, you know, the whole country's hearts go out to New York and New Jersey, after a day or two, everybody else in the country moved on. So I think in many ways, I think Matt's right that the period in the early summer when the Obama campaign was able to define Mitt Romney was a real telling point. But I think there were other strategic and campaign decisions that are really important here. The what we call the ground game, you know, the way in which the Obama organization organized people in those battleground states. Mitt Romney's campaign made a strategic decision to turn a lot of the ground game work over to the Republican National Committee. And they did it in part to save money themselves for television advertising. And I think the RNC's ground game clearly is not as good, or at least was not as effective as the candidate-driven ground game that the president had that was, you know, first, foremost, and last about him and his reelection.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Governor Romney's strategy of sort of outsourcing some of that, to use a perhaps ironic phrase, which I didn't intend until it came out of my mouth, but, you know, the RNC's ground game was certainly about trying to elect Governor Romney, but they had all other kinds of candidates that they were working on behalf of. And so I think that there are, you know, just some strategic decisions in ways like that that also had a real impact.
Man, I'm wondering how strong a candidate you think Mitt Romney was. He was governor of Massachusetts for 4 years. He did the Olympics. And he was a wildly successful businessman. Is that resume deep enough to be a serious, serious candidate for president?
Well, it's probably deep enough to be a serious candidate, although sort of a different question about, you know, what kind of candidate he was. I mean, he sort of grew into it a little bit. I think he got better over time. He's certainly much better than he was 4 years ago. And I think he was better at the end of the campaign than he was when he started. But he did have trouble, I think, connecting with people on sort of a gut level. He was not a very good sort of retail politician when you saw him in diners or just small chit-chat with voters very early in the campaign. There were awkward moments. He had trouble sometimes, I think, making that connection. And he didn't fully connect, on a mass scale either. The Romney campaign did have a very effective, probably the most effective piece that they put together was this biographical, 10 minutes, very inspirational biography of Mitt Romney that played at the Republican National Convention. They played it at their rallies in the final bit, but it never got seen by a mass audience. I mean, it sort of highlighted his family story, his business career, a lot of the things on his resume that sort of made him a good candidate and sort of have the qualifications that we tend to look for in our presidents. But it was just that sort of, do you want to hang out with Mitt Romney sort of question, that I don't know that they ever sort of fully conquered.
Let's go to a couple of phone calls for both of you. And let's start with Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, I'm afraid we may be off to a rather difficult start right from the start. Your last guest, Margaret Farrell, ended her comments saying that Obama has to learn how to sit down and compromise. And I won't read the whole thing, but I went online and found former Senator Simpson's remarks to his own party this year about how his own party's stymieing any debt reduction agreement and told them that they're a bunch of purists and should. He said, if you want to be a purist, go somewhere on a mountaintop and praise the East or something. But if you want to be in politics, you learn to compromise. He was talking about his own party, characterized Obama as flexible but caught in a no-win situation. So I'm kind of worried that even before the confetti is swept up, we're just into the same mess. And I'll listen off the air.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Matt. What do you think?
I think you're already, seeing some signs of that. I mean, Mitch McConnell had a statement last night that was very much sort of, digging in his heels, so to say. I mean, it was kind of forecasting a lot of the next couple weeks, and how divisive they may be. I mean, I don't know that anybody from this election, at least so far, is sort of saying, okay, we have to come together and we have to solve some of these problems. It's more, we have to sort of stick to our guns, at least on the Republican side, it seems. John Boehner is going to have a press conference this afternoon as well, so I think we'll get some other clues from the House leadership. Republicans still control the House. It's still a narrow majority for the Democrats in the Senate. So I think there will be a lot of battles, in the next couple of weeks in particular.
Do you think it will be just as rough, just as much partisanship as we've had the last 4 years, Professor Dolan?
Well, it's going to remain to be seen, but, as Matt said, there are no early indications that it's going to be anything different. It certainly might be that, this is the sort of morning after effects. People are still bruised and hurting. Mm-hmm. There'll be several postmortems. when Senator McConnell 2 years ago said, you know, the goal for the next 2 years was to work to make President Obama a one-term president, they clearly, you know, for 2 years stymied things. The question moving forward is going to be, can they stymie him for another four? You know, are we at a state of political paralysis such that we are just going to, you know, muddle through for 4 years until the next election? I have to think that's untenable, but, you know, we don't know. It is not, I think, terribly useful for us to try to predict moving forward that one group or the other is going to have any sort of large epiphany. I think the president has shown, you know, ways in which many Democrats and progressives would suggest he has been flexible, perhaps to a fault. So a lot is going to depend on the Republican leadership. The fiscal cliff, you know, that we're all talking about now is going to be a real telling point, but that will evolve over the next, you know, 6-8 weeks, and maybe that will give us some early sign.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Teresa in Neenah. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. For your guests, I have a question regarding the money that was used from political action committees, and oftentimes you couldn't even tell who it was coming from, and if they wonder if there might be changes in this sort of thing happening in the future for elections.
Oh, the money, Matt, the money.
I mean, I think, you know, you could see some effort to change it, although, you know, there was certainly was a lot of money, and there was a lot of money spent on ads. It's hard to sort of get a pulse on sort of how effective they were at changing things on the presidential scale. I mean, the super PACs, I think, played a role in some of the Senate races and the House races, and they played a role in helping Mitt Romney in the primary campaign. But in the general election, there weren't a huge number of ads that seemed to define the race in a different way than the candidates themselves were defining it. So I think that's another sort of interesting question and sort of the fallout of this, and that we'll sort of all sort of turn to, you know, is sort of what role did money have, and is there something that should be changed? And I think Democrats have wanted to change the campaign finance system, you know, whether or not Republicans will agree with them, you know, in doing that, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and one of the things I think is a sort of ironic point here, and I don't want this to be our takeaway necessarily, but the super PAC money, you know, was about 85% spent on behalf of Governor Romney. And so an enormous wave of money spent post-Citizens United, spent, you know, almost exclusively negative and almost exclusively targeted at defeating the president, and it failed. So, you know, people on the left particularly panicked coming out of the Citizens United decision that they would be overwhelmed by Republican money. And Matt is right that there probably are places in the House and Senate where this money made more of a difference. But at some level, it's almost crazy that much money could have been spent on negative ads to tear down a president, and then it had no impact. Or not no impact, but it did not succeed. So the sort of hand-wringing, you know, gnashing of teeth that people were concerned about doesn't seem, at least yet, to have come to fruition.
And I don't both of you find it ironic that here we've had this horrible, devastating storm. We're talking about rebuilding infrastructure in our major cities, and we're spending this incredible amount of money at the risk of being too simplistic here. Don't we need to sit down, everybody, Republicans and Democrats, and say, couldn't this money be better spent, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I may be missing this quote, but I think I saw Haley Barbour, the governor of Mississippi, former governor of Mississippi and big-time Republican, saying the other day that, you know, they spend as much on the presidential campaign as Americans do on Doritos or something like that. You know, something also sort of very trivial. But, you know, I do think that, you know, the money could certainly be put to better use. I mean, I think President Obama, you know, was the first. He opted out of the public system 4 years ago. I think that's created this new system in some ways where the presidential candidates, this is the first time that neither presidential candidate has been in the public financing system for their campaigns. And so, you know, it's this sort of new era where the candidates spend an enormous amount of time fundraising and an enormous time trying to cultivate their donors. You know, I mean, Mitt Romney took a bunch of his donors over to on a foreign trip and went to Israel, and you know there was a lot of time spent. You know, and Obama went to George Clooney's,
right.
fundraiser and raised a bunch of money there. So I mean, I think there was just a lot of attention and a lot of time spent by both of the candidates on raising money, and you know, I think it's a good question of whether that's a good use of their time and whether there's sort of a better way of doing it.
So Mr. or Ms. Smith can no longer go to Washington, huh?
well although, you know, like we were saying, that it didn't work necessarily. You know, so it's a question of sort of, you know, what is the impact of money on politics? And, you know, is there a threshold by which more money doesn't matter, you know, in spending? So, you know, maybe... And, you know, depending on how much money, Mr. Smith needs to have some money, but, you know, he may not need to have the most money.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having
Matt Visor, national political reporter at the Boston Globe. Does it cut a lot of people out of politics, Professor Dolan?
Well, it does cut a lot of people out of politics, but probably where it is most important is the perception that cuts people out of politics. Because one of the things that we know from the kind of work that I do in political science on, I do a lot of my work on women candidates for office, and one of the things that we know dissuades a lot of people from running is the assumption they make that they would have to raise enormous amounts of money and that they couldn't do it or they wouldn't want to do it. And so one of the things that the impact of money creates is a candidate pool that is structured in a way, as Matt says, where the successful candidates are those people who can spend enormous amounts of time raising money and, quite frankly, who have the personalities, you know, who have the ability to say to a crowded room, give me money because I'm the right person to do this. So I think where we might be losing as a society is a perhaps richer candidate pool, where we're not organically growing people who don't come with money and with the connections to money right away, and the discouraging sort of tone that it sets that the average person couldn't step in because they could never access those sorts of arenas.
We welcome more phone calls in a moment. Professor Kathleen Dolan remaining with us throughout the hour. She's a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. A little bit later this half hour, Jonathan Alter will be joining us. He was at McCormick Place last night. You may have seen him, some of you, on television. He's a terrific historian. I just happen to be reading at this moment the FDR's 100 Days in the Triumph of Hope, and he's written a major book on President Obama as well, The Promise. So he will join us along with Kathleen. And you will take more of your calls. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@wpr.org. The Facebook page, if you'd like to leave your comments about what happened yesterday, we'd love to read them. That's the Facebook page of Kathleen Dunn. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's take some more phone calls. Anne in Milwaukee, hello.
This is kind of a trivial question compared with the things you've just been talking about, but how do we know last night that 45% of the men voted this way and 55% of the women voted this way? I don't put my sex down when I vote. How does that work?
Well, those are figures that are calculated based on the exit polls that are taken around the country. So there is a consortium of media organizations that goes out into the field around the country and does exit polling, where they talk to voters after they have cast their ballots and essentially do a survey. They ask them questions about for whom they voted, if they're willing to share, and what motivated their vote, and what issues in which they were most interested, and then they gather demographic data about those voters' education and income and sex and things like that. So the projections that we have about how people behaved and for whom they voted come from the exit polls.
Thanks very much. The president, during his speech last night, gave a couple indications. I'm wondering what you think about these. One, he mentioned these election lines being too long. Somebody's got to do something about Florida. This is just amazing. Election after election, they can't seem to get this process right.
Well, I think what the president was saying was that we have to do something about elections in general. And one thing that we need to keep in mind is that elections in the United States are controlled very heavily by state and even more heavily by local governments. It is one of the pieces of our system of federalism where we give so much power to state and local governments. One of the things that is increasingly apparent across elections is that local governments are different in the amount of money that they have and in the number of resources that they are willing to commit to elections. And so we are rapidly moving into a world in which elections are determined by the resources that are marshaled on the ground. And I think that if we mean anything as a democracy, we want everybody to be able to exercise their right to vote in the same way. And the pictures we saw from all over the country last night of people waiting in line for hours
Yes.
to vote, that is in part because there is this fundamental mismatch between the resources, the literal machines and poll workers and precinct opportunities that local elections officials put out as available mismatched with the numbers of voters who are showing up. So whether it is intentional or unintentional, it is clear to us that in many, many places around the country, local governments can't or won't commit the resources that are needed. So I think what President Obama was referring to was this notion that we have to regularize our elections process in some way. We can certainly still allow for local control, but we have to make sure that people are not standing in line for hours to exercise their right to vote in some places, and in other places, you know, breezing in and out because everything is perfectly
okay. Right, yeah. Chris in Oshkosh, hi.
Yes, good morning, Kathleen. How are you today?
All right, Chris.
Hey, at the very outset of your show, your guest referred to, you were actually discussing the Florida results, and there was a kind of off-the-cuff reference to the Hispanic vote. And I spend a tremendous amount of time in South Florida, and I think there's a real tendency to misunderstand Hispanics, especially in this context, that in South Florida, you're not talking about some sort of a unified Hispanic thing. The Hispanic community is vast and diverse, and down there you're talking primarily Cubans who vote almost exclusively Republican. So how would your guest respond to that?
Well, and my understanding is that young Cubans are not voting exclusively Republican. Is that yours as well, Chris?
It's a shift. The younger, you're right, there is a shift to the left on the part of the successive generations, but you cannot place them in the same context
right.
as a Arizona Mexican, for example, or a Salvadoran in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
There are blocks of Hispanics
right.
who are religiously Democratic, but they are not in Florida.
Right. Professor
Dillon. And that's exactly right. And we can't speak about a Latino vote being a sort of unanimous either ethnic bloc or behavioral bloc in any state around the country. And in Florida, that may be particularly true because of the Cuban population. We know, of course, that the Cuban population in Florida is going to vote more Republican than not, although, as Kathleen suggests, younger Cubans are not showing the same patterns as their parents and grandparents, perhaps. But Florida, Latinos and Latinas are diversifying as well because the Latino population in Florida is not exclusively or even overwhelmingly Cuban anymore. So we do have to acknowledge the ways in which Latinos do not vote as a bloc, just in the same way we would acknowledge that no racial or ethnic or sex-based group votes as a bloc. But overall, when we aggregate that Latino vote, it is overwhelmingly Democratic.
Overwhelmingly. I mean, it was huge last night.
Yeah, well,
absolutely huge.
Yeah.
And I heard this morning that the Latino vote was greater this election than it was in 2008.
As a percentage of the electorate, do you mean? Or
yes.
Yes. I think that's right, but not hugely up. I mean, I can check the figures here. I was looking at some of the demographics in the exit polls just to see where the different groups were coming from. Let's see.
That's right. You can check. We'll take a call and we'll get to that. 800-486-8655 is our number. Rich in Rhinelander. Hi.
Good morning, and don't hang up on me. I'm looking forward to the 2014 midterm elections, and
here's why. Rich, no.
I can explain what's happening in Wisconsin and in the nation. there's been a war on wage earners and salaried employees over the last 30 years in terms of their pay scales. And some people believe low paid equals submissive. Well, low paid does not equal submissive at all. What we've done in Wisconsin, basically, in our progressive tradition, is we've said we'll give you a chance to engage in bold experiments. Governor Walker, you say you can create or call forth 250,000 jobs within your term. Let's see what you can do. As a matter of fact, the Republicans now are going to be totally responsible in the state of Wisconsin for looking to that goal. And for President Barack Obama, and I am so glad to see perhaps the longest stage death in history of racism on the stage, because I'm an older man and I've lived through a lot, and I think this election proves that the next generation is not going to care very much. But they've said to President Obama, we trusted you. We think you're a hard worker. We want to see what you can do in another 4 years. And that's consistent within the progressive tradition. It's not a maverick state with a lot of crazy people in it who think they can see Alaska from their front porches. It's a state where people really say, let's give new ideas a chance. If they work, you'll be reelected in 2014. If stuff doesn't work, goodbye.
Thank you, Rich, for the call. Professor Dolan.
Well, I think Rich is right. I mean, at some level, I think that Wisconsin has shown itself to be in some ways a microcosm of a lot of the debates that have been going on over the last, 10 years or so, and certainly accelerated in the last four or five. I mean, Wisconsin has, in voting for President Obama last night, continues its support for Democratic presidential candidates that goes back to 1984. But if we look at 2008, President Obama's 14 percentage point victory here in Wisconsin was an enormous outlier. The margins by which Wisconsin voted for Al Gore in 2000 and John Kerry in 2004 were much closer and much tighter. And so 2012, brings a little bit more competition back at the presidential level, which reflects, the fact that we're not, a state that always goes in one direction or the other. And clearly the intervening election of Governor Walker and the successful his successful retention in office, shows that there are voters in Wisconsin who are willing to try different ideas and to go in different directions. But, at its heart, we're still a pretty competitive place sort of debating these ideas.
Yeah, it still is. And this will be the focus of some of our conversation next hour. How do you explain a state that elects Scott Walker and Tammy Baldwin? It's worthy of some discussion, and we'll get into that some with Chuck Hornbach, the second hour of our program. You may join all of our conversation. We're talking about what we did yesterday in terms of the election on the show for both hours today. Professor Kathleen Dolan is joining us. She is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. In just a little while, Jonathan Alter will join us. Jonathan was all over TV last night. He was at McCormick Place, and he will be with us, and we'll welcome more of your phone calls. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jonathan Alter joining us for a couple minutes. His books include The Promise, President Obama, Year One, and he's also written a terrific biography of FDR, or FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. He was in McCormick Place last night. Jonathan Alter, hello. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
Yeah, great to have you here. How many people were there last night? It was quite a scene, wasn't it?
It was, they filled up a chunk of McCormick Place. It wasn't as many people as when I was out 4 years ago in Grant Park, but I think it was prudent to hold it indoors this time. It was still a very impressive event in his hometown and the town of my birth, so it was meaningful for me.
Mm-hmm. What is the significance, Jonathan, and we'll move into this, we'll live into this, but what was the significance of reelecting our first African-American president? What does it say?
Well, I think it's a real kind of moment of passage to a new America. We've been moving in a more multicultural direction for some time, but now we've clearly kind of arrived in that future. If he had been rejected, it would have been consistent with a pattern of fits and starts in racial advancement and arguably in racial justice as well, you know, over the course of the last couple of centuries, where we would sort of take, two steps forward, one step back. There were many examples of that in American history. So now nobody can take this away from him, even mm-hmm. if he has an unsuccessful second term in terms of getting things through Congress and runs into trouble of one kind or another. He cannot be seen as somebody who was rejected by the American people. And that is extremely important, not just for African Americans, but also for American progressives. Because I do think that, two terms makes all the difference in the world when you're assessing a president historically. If he had lost last night, he would have been more in the Jimmy Carter department. Now he'll be in the Ronald Reagan maybe even Bill Clinton department, although Bill Clinton's second term was not very successful at all. So that's a pretty low bar for Obama to improve upon.
He mentioned last night, and I'm wondering if you heard other indications of issues he may take on. He talked about the warming planet, which I thought was important for him to say that. It's a controversial issue still in this country. We have read that maybe he will take that on in a big way in the second administration. Do you think he will? Why did he include that phrase? And are there other issues that you think he really wants to move forward on?
Well, he tried with cap and trade that got through the House in 2009 and was rejected in the Senate. So he clearly is interested in doing something on climate change. He did get through very important new mileage standards. And what I've heard from inside the White House in the last week or so is that the president has been talking a lot about what we're going to have to do to protect our economy from a climate change future that, like that multicultural future I was talking about, is here. This is not something that's in the future. This is now. And so do we need to talk about Seagates to protect the 15% of our economy that's in the New York area? There are a lot of big new issues on the table after this storm. And, he is eager to take them on. He doesn't have to worry about, politics right now. That doesn't mean he's going to get everything through Congress necessarily, but he won't put it up high on the agenda. And I also think we are going to see a big push for comprehensive immigration reform. He got over 70% of the Latino vote.
Amazing.
That powered his victory. And I think the Republican Party understands that it needs to confront this problem or it will go extinct as a political party. They really have no choice now but to resolve their differences on immigration and join with the Democrats to really address this problem. So I do think that there's a chance for real progress on immigration unless the Republicans are kind of suicidal about it.
Yeah, and just finally, I know you're a busy guy. Where else do you see there might be some kind of compromise here, some let's serve the public, let's work together?
Well, I think they are going to have a compromise on long-term deficit reduction. And, they've got what they call the fiscal cliff coming up. And so you'll see literally trillions in longer-term deficit reduction, refashioning government, but along more compassionate lines than, your Congressman Paul Ryan believes in. The Ryan budget was cruel. It was cruel to poor people. It shredded the safety net. And if you look closely at it, you can come to no other conclusion when you're talking about things like cutting, 30-40% from Medicaid. That's not going to happen now. And we'll find other ways to reduce the deficit. And so this was a big election in terms of the future direction of this country. We're going to have a more compassionate approach to deficit reduction. That doesn't mean it's going to be pleasant. And there will be cuts, but it'll be more of the way that, say, Andrew Cuomo has done it in New York State than the way Scott Walker has done it in Wisconsin. It'll be less confrontational, and I think the president will be able to, you know, go to his constituency groups in the Democratic Party and say, look, you're not thrilled with this, but it's better that we do this and begin to, move toward some new policy ideas. He's already done that on education, you know, which didn't leave the teachers' unions very happy, but they stuck with them. And I think you'll see him do that with a series of other Democratic constituency groups in order to put the country on a sounder fiscal footing moving forward, which we all know we have to do.
Mm. Jonathan, thank you so much. Great job last night. And I just happen to be rereading your FDR book right now, which is terrific. So,
thank you so much. I'm really delighted to hear that. Thanks
so much, Jonathan. Jonathan Alter, his books include The Promise, President Obama Year One, and The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. He was at McCormick Place last night. Professor Dolan, there's so much to talk about. We haven't talked about Paul Ryan. Obviously, the president didn't carry this state. Do you think this a good VP pick or not?
In the end, I think it probably was less successful than it could have been. I mean, we say in political science that vice presidential candidates generally don't make a lot of difference to a ticket. I think Paul Ryan coming out of the House of Representatives, it was challenging for him. You know, I think it was probably a bit naive for the Republicans to think that his pick really would put Wisconsin in play, because while he is a home state guy, he was not really known to the state. He's known, you know, better inside the Beltway than he might be outside the first congressional district. So I don't think he brought what they had hoped here. I do think that he helped open up the debate about entitlements, and as Jonathan Alter was just suggesting, about, you know, what many people believe to be an incredibly draconian plan to cut the deficit. He brought that into the campaign in a way that Governor Romney might not necessarily have brought that in himself without that pick. So I think he brought some liabilities in terms of the way the party was framed and a way Governor Romney was defined, because Governor Romney became completely defined by Paul Ryan's budget, and that's generally not the dynamic you want. You don't want the bottom of the ticket sort of driving the issue agenda to that degree. So I think in the end there probably were better picks, and by better I mean picks that might have advanced the ticket a little bit more, except that we know that, you know, in almost every circumstance, other than perhaps a pick like Sarah Palin, vice presidential candidates generally don't do that much.
Elaine in Colfax. Hi, Elaine.
Hello. I just wanted to say that I think the American people just grew up yesterday. Hope and change isn't easy. The president doesn't have a magic wand. Hope and change is very hard work, and it takes a village. The president has the chance to use his great oratory gifts, his prose and poetry, to inspire this the people this term. You can see his intelligent leadership in the way he sensitively handled an international event getting Osama bin Laden, even with disposing of his body at sea in a culturally respectful manner. And you can see his practical, hands-on response to the disaster in the northeast, and his ability to work with a Republican governor with honest graciousness to get something done. But I think what he really needs this term is to grow bolder and not to kowtow to the right-wing fanatics.
Professor Dolan, does he need to be bolder?
Well, he has the ability to be bolder to the degree that he doesn't have to face the voters ever again. But he has less of an ability to be bold because he's working with a divided Congress. I mean, if he can use his bully pulpit, if he can use what the caller refers to as his oratorical gifts, I mean, if he uses the leadership that the presidency allows people to try to bring public opinion to his side, to then perhaps put some pressure on Congress to work with him in a more collaborative way, then some of these issues, you know, certainly could be brought to fruition. But, we'll wake up tomorrow and the next day and the next day, and about half of the country, you know, will be as opposed to him as they were yesterday when they voted. So I think what the caller articulates is one perspective on the issue. I think that there are lots of people who believe for, you know, whatever sets of reasons that his path is the wrong one. And so I don't know that we're at a place. Politics feels so polarized that I'm not sure that we can really characterize this as one of those moments where people, you know, put aside their differences to work for the greater good.
Well, at least by tomorrow we will have had a good night's sleep, though.
Right.
Yeah. Thanks, Professor Dolan, so much for being with us.
Sure.
Professor Kathleen Dolan, Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. We also thank presidential historian Jonathan Alter and Matt Visor, national political reporter for the Boston Globe, for this jam-packed first hour of the program. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produced this program. We'll continue talking about what we did yesterday, the second hour of our program, so please stay with us on the Ideas Network.